100 UV, this is already getting experimentally difficult. Specifically, stuff like Technicolor is highly disfavored now. Electric precision tests, and of course, you want to see some new particles. And then there's a sort of an intermediate regime where the cutoff is like somewhat higher, like maybe between 5 and 10 TeV, and you're trying to use a symmetry principle to make the Higgs more or less natural. So this is the little hierarchy problem that I'm referring to. So, and for this talk, I will be discussing this scenario. And so, for all practical purposes, the cutoff of where I stop explaining things will be around 5-10 TeV. And so, at that point, you assume that there are some more conventional solution to the hierarchy problem coming in, like compositeness or supersymmetry. So, we're focusing on the little hierarchy problem. And so, in this context, there is sort of a loose theorem, a top partner theorem that you can say is that if I protect the Higgs with a symmetry, then that symmetry, of course, non-trivially acts on the Higgs. And because of the large Topiokawa, if I don't want to badly break the symmetry and already spoil my mechanism from the start, it also needs to act on the top sector. So the top needs to be a multiplet in whatever symmetry the protects the Higgs. And that means that it has a partner particle. So there is some sort of top partner. And in terms of diagrams, this thing is going to be responsible for canceling off the quadratic divergence that is introduced by the top itself. And the usual suspects for this are supersymmetry or global symmetry. Supersymmetry, the partner is a scalar. Cancel it off just because of the different sign in the diagram. And for global symmetry, the partner is a fermion, and you generate some sort of irrelevant operator which comes with the right coefficient to cancel off the quadratic divergence. But in both of these cases, both supersymmetry and global symmetry, they commute with QCD. And so that implies that this top partner here is always colored. So the stop is colored and the T prime is also colored. And what I'm interested in today is to see if this assumption can be relaxed. Can we come up with sort of sensible scenarios where this symmetry that protects the Higgs does not necessarily commute with QCD? And so then I will not necessarily have a colored top partner, which will allow me to greatly relax collider constraints.
Sorry, isn't that what you mean global?
Yes. That is my next slide, or two slides from now. That's correct. So why would you want to perhaps do this? It's sorry. Yes, yeah, we're squeezing blot from, so these are the stones, right? So this is a some example of a T prime in a composite Higgs model where you have like the Higgs is a pseudo-Goldstone boson of a global symmetry, and you see that the bounds here range between 600 and 800 GeV just from collider constraints because these things are produced with strong cross-sections. More familiar example for the stops that work the same way. You can still squeeze yourself underneath here to reduce the missing energy. You can do things like RPV, and all of these things are out there, and they're important to completely wipe out, and maybe we'll eventually do that. So that's squeezing out. Yes?
Strongest bounds are coming from the decay into mostly TZ.
You are looking at which plot?
The one on the right.
This one, yes.
So the most constrained
That's
part
right.
is the decay to TZ, and the least constrained is to W.
That is right. That's the way to read these things. So the shading is sort of so the lightest. I guess this is presumably it's hard to see, but it's presumably sort of where you split it up a little bit in between. Yeah. So this triangle just parameterizes the branching ratios to these various. But so the point I want to make is that okay, 600 GeV, maybe that's okay, but at that point, like if you start pushing this higher, at some point it becomes not a very good mechanism anymore to protect the Higgs because if I split the top partners, I reintroduce fine-tuning. And so while all of this stuff is certainly still useful and we need to beat as much out of it as we can, given that we have the experimental capability, I think it's already useful to start exploring maybe slightly more general setups where you see how difficult is it to remove the color charge of this thing. So from the bottom-up point of view, this is actually very extremely trivial in some sense. Because the only place where QCD comes in is in these color factors in this loop over here. So this is just a number 3. At one loop, I don't see the QCD scale. It doesn't need to be, I don't necessarily care that this is a strongly coupled sector or whatnot. The other thing that I need is that the Yukawa needs to be the same for, needs to be more or less the same to high precision for the top and the top partner. But as far as the QCD charge is concerned, like any thing that comes with three copies and has a Topikawa, in principle, it qualifies as a candidate. From a top-down point of view, you're looking, as I already said, for a symmetry which does not commute with QCD. So the Higgs is protected by it, but it does not necessarily imply that all the members of the multiplet have color charge. And so I'm going to refer to this sort of symmetry as an accidental symmetry, in the sense that it cannot be a symmetry of the full theory, because like it's explicitly broken by the QCD couplings. But I'm going to require that this thing holds in a one-loop effective action for the Higgs potential. So if it holds at one loop, then it takes me to, let's say, 5-10 TeV, and at that point, some more powerful mechanism comes in, like supersymmetry or like a composite Higgs kind of scenario. And so now we come to the twin Higgs is sort of the simplest example of this sort of thing that exists. So let's take global symmetry. So let's start with a toy model where I have an SU4 global symmetry. This H is just in the fundamental of this SU4 and it has this particular potential. So once I go, this potential will spontaneously break the SU4 to an SU3, and that will generate 7 Goldstones for me. And so what I can do is I can gauge an SU2 cross SU2 subgroup in this SU4. And this is going to eat, if the vacuum alignment is correct, as we'll discuss later, this will eat 6 of the 7 Goldstones. There's one Goldstone that remains uneaten. And I can try to identify that Goldstone with the standard model Higgs. So it's protected because it's a Goldstone of this sort of SU4 symmetry. Now, of course, the complaint is here that, well, I explicitly broke this SU4 by gauging the subgroup over here. And so at the one loop action, this thing is going to get corrections like this, which spoil the SU4 symmetry. So there is the two gauge couplings come in here, and so the one loop quadratic action gets corrected like this.
So AJ and AB
are the gauge couplings of these guys, of these two gauge fields.
Do they differ cases?
Yeah, so AAH.
Okay.
Yeah, so this multiplet is broken up like this. And so these are the gauge couplings of the SUA and SUB sector. And so the original idea behind twin Higgs is, well, what if I add like one extra ingredient? And what if I suppose that there exists a Z2 symmetry which interchanges these two sectors? If I assume that this symmetry exists, then I set the gauge couplings to be equal. And then this thing factors out in front. And this term here arranges itself in a one-loop effective action as a SU4 invariant. And so the quartic, if you write a quartic, it will not be SU4 invariant. But that's OK, because that will only introduce a logarithmic sensitivity to the cutoff for me. But this thing, because it's an SU4 invariant, if the Higgs is a pseudo-Goldstone of this SU4, it cannot be proportional to this invariant. So that's what makes it insensitive to the quadratic divergence over here. But it relies on having this sort of Z2 symmetry that interchanges these two things, and then in addition, gauge invariance constrains you to just writing down this. It's the only thing you can write down in the quadratic action. So that's in a nutshell the idea behind a twin Higgs setup. And so it's not, as we said before, it's not an exact symmetry of the entire theory because it's explicitly broken by this gauging, but it's still sort of an accidental symmetry of the term in the Lagrangian that you care of. And so this is sort of the general idea. The Higgs is pseudo-Goldstone model of an accidental symmetry. And the reason why this thing persists is because of a Z2 symmetry, despite the fact that I explicitly broke it. So that was just a toy example. Yes? In this toy example, it will be. But as soon as if you add more stuff, you're going to start correcting the, like now I'm going to add the Yukawas over here, right? So now you may worry that these Yukawas get corrected at two loops, right? And so then it may not hold at two loops, depending on what model you build. But isn't the toy example that I with no Yukawas, it holds to all orders, but it's not the most interesting thing. So yeah, so what do you do if you want to do something more realistic? So you take the standard model and you say, okay, let me just make two copies of that thing, right? So make two copies of the standard model. And I say, okay, the standard model and the mirror standard model, as they call it, they're related by C2 symmetry. All the couplings are the same in both sectors because of this symmetry. So that means that for the Higgs sector, for the top sector, sorry, this is the standard model top, this is the twin top, the Yukawas are the same over here. That's very important. So once I do that, I again have that I spontaneously break the symmetry of 7 Goldstones. And so for now, I'm going to the limit where the standard model of F is sort of small. The standard model of F, standard model of Higgs would live over here, but it sort of complicates the equation. So I'm going to the limit where it's small and that all the V is dumped in this F over here. So then you expand this linear sigma model into the nonlinear sigma model. These are the Goldstone matrix, where I only wrote down the part of it that aligns to the standard model Higgs. And so once you expand out this exponential here, you find that this A-type thing is mostly proportional to standard model Higgs plus small corrections. And the B-type Higgs is mostly aligned with this VEF. And you pick up this irrelevant operator over here if you stick it in over here. So that's this term for the T prime. And so you find that this thing automatically has the correct coefficients to cancel off the quadratic divergence that's introduced with the from the top partner. And so this sounds a little bit strange, but this is just an artifact of the fact that you had a global symmetry under which you were a Goldstone. So this expansion had to arrange itself such that this would happen. And this is the same in other models where the Higgs is pseudo-Goldstone boson. So, but in conventional models, this thing is just a colored top partner. So this is the T prime then. But so in our case, if we're doing an accidental symmetry, this thing does not have to be charged under QCD, and I can have this thing to be like 100, 200 GeV if I want, without any problems with collider physics.
But the 3 here is the 3 of the QCD prime.
That's correct. Yeah, so there's 3 guys running in here, and that is the twin version of this QCD over here. Absolutely, yeah. So that's how that works. But now you could raise a couple of complaints, some of which Mina already raised during lunch. He's like, well, okay, you doubled me the entire standard model, so I'm stuck with like a host of twin neutrinos, twin leptons, all that sort of stuff. What happens with cosmology for these things? Like, do I worry about that? And you worry about these things. So it's quite inelegant and very baroque to do this. But if you don't, then you worry, well, let's say I only put the top sector, which is the most minimal thing. That's the only thing I care for the quadratic divergence. Then you wonder where the Z2 is coming from, because now the gauge couplings get corrected at 2 loops at different sectors. And so there needs to be some scale, which, yes. Yeah, sorry, the gauge couplings get corrected at 1 loop,
yeah.
And then that feeds in at 2 loops for the Higgs. That's right, that's correct, yeah. Or for G2. Or for G2, right? If G2 is a 1 loop corrected, then that gives a 2 loop non-invariant correction to the Higgs.
Yes.
Yeah. That's right. Sorry?
What is the mass of the second
Higgs? The mass of the second Higgs will be around between 500 GeV and a TeV-ish. Yeah. So you mean the radial mode of the. So there's going to be one. There's going to be a radial mode for the. There's only one Goldstone that's uneaten, and then there is a radial mode. And that radial mode will be proportional to roughly the vacuum expectation value of this F, which will be around a TeV-ish, or a little bit lighter even.
There's a bump around 400 or 500 GeV seen by Atlas, but not by CMS.
Yes.
It's over 3 sigma.
Yeah.
It's been around for a while.
Right. I don't think this can qualify, because there's going to be mixing angles. So this is mostly aligned with the twin sector. So it couples very weakly to the standard model. So even if this thing lifts at 450 GeV, I don't think the rate would be high enough to explain this bump. Because there is a mixing angle suppression for this thing. Yeah. Yeah. So I think that rate would be very small for this thing. But I haven't computed it, of course. But yeah.
You can grow the signal.
Right. It may grow, yeah. And then if it ends up growing, I don't know if this would be the place where I put my money. But it's definitely worth checking at that point, yeah. Yes, so you wonder, like, okay, where is the Z2 coming from? Ideally, there is some sort of scale at which you integrate out something above which the theory is approximately symmetric under the Z2, and then so you don't run too much and you end up there. But so at some point, you need to say, like, where is this thing, this accidental symmetry originating from? I'm going to try to explain one avenue where that could come from. And another question is, which I think is also very interesting, is this just like one particular pathological case, Or does there exist like a more general class of models where this sort of accidental symmetries show up? Because in some sense, we're just scratching the surface, right? We understand very well how exact symmetries protect the Higgs. But in terms of accidental symmetries, the only examples known is the twin Higgs and then something called folded supersymmetry, where you do something similar for supersymmetry. But each of these cases, each of these examples are just very basic examples. So this was my intro, and so I will explain how we think we can make progress on the first question by using an orbifold to get the twin Higgs model. And then once you have this orbifold story, then you can very easily generalize this and produce lots of other interesting, more general models which have very interesting phenomenology. So on the level that I'm going to be interested in for today, there's two ways you can think of an orbifold. Like on a purely field theory level, you can think of it just as a map between two field theories. So you have a mother field theory that you then map onto a daughter field theory. And some of the properties of the mother are carrying over to the daughter, and you're going to make use of that. Now, I should emphasize perhaps that it does not necessarily imply that the mother theory flows to the daughter theory. So it doesn't mean automatically that the mother is a UV completion of the daughter, because sometimes there is some confusion on that. But to make progress on the UV completion, yes. Okay. Sorry?
Sorry, what does that mean?
Does what mean? So this is just a map between two field theories. And in some cases, this map is actually in equivalence. So you can...
Yes.
But so one should not think of this mother theory in some sense in the field theory level as UV completion of the daughter. But in a sense that it provides you information on UV completion is that if you take a geometric orbifold, where you start, for instance, from a 5D setup, where the symmetries in the bulk are the same as the symmetries in the mother theory, and then you perform the orbifold, you find that the zero modes have the symmetry of the daughter. So in that higher dimensional sense, the mother theory provides some sort of UV completion for the daughter, but not in the fully 4D sense. So this is what I just said, right? So this alone is not satisfactory to get a UV completion, but once you add in a sort of geometric setup, then you have a way of RG flowing from something that looks like the mother theory to the daughter theory, and then you have confidence that maybe this is useful. But it is a very, because this is much simpler than this, it's a very useful intermediate step to do this first. And so you can get a sense of what the theory should look like. And then you add on like the details of the extra dimension later. And this is very similar to, for those of you who are familiar with this stuff, what was done in gut orbifold theories, where you break the gut symmetry in SU5 or in SO10 with boundary conditions or orbifolds to get down to the standard model symmetry. And so you use the field theory orbifold in some sense as a model generator to figure out like what are sensible models, and then you UV complete them later. So it's an algorithm in some sense. And this is how the algorithm works. So you start with some sort of mother theory that has a fairly large symmetry, and you identify a discrete symmetry in this mother theory, and then you just eliminate everything that's not invariant under it, and you're left over with a much smaller theory with less fields, which has some properties that are shared between the mother and the daughter. And so, for instance, the example at hand, I can start with, let's say, an SU4 gauge symmetry, just pure SU4, and I'm going to orbifold this out, mod this out with a Z2 discrete symmetry. The Z2 discrete symmetry I can, for instance, define as this action over here. It's embedded in the SU4, and it acts as the adjoint on the gluons. And so I want that these gluons are invariant under this action, so then what I am left with is like this block over here commutes with this thing, this block over here also commutes, and then I have this diagonal element, this diagonal U1, which commutes. And so I end up with this breaking pattern. So the off-diagonal blocks are being removed from the theory by doing this projection. So that's like algorithmically how it works. But so why is this? Yes.
Your statement is just that, if you go back one slide.
Yes.
That, if you wanted the four energies, SU2 plus SU2 plus U1,
mm-hmm.
then by identifying this discrete symmetry and by identifying this breaking pattern, you're guaranteed that there is a UV completion that sort of generates this.
That is the idea, yes. Because so automatically, of course, so I broke this down. I should have emphasized perhaps. So this thing has a gauge coupling G, for instance. So the gauge couplings of these two guys are the same, of course, right? Because it comes from the same Lagrangian. I just stripped off some fields. but the gauge coupling is the same. So at this level, this is just an abstract trick, and I have not explained to you where it comes from, why it's useful, but this is going to be interesting. And so the reason why this may be interesting is because in the sort of formal end of the literature, there's sort of a theorem that in some cases, the correlation functions of the daughter theory map onto the correlation functions of the mother theory. So that means if I protect the Higgs in the mother theory, so the correlation function does not have a quadratic divergence, but even though the mother is not realistic because there's too many fields, if I can then project my way down to a daughter theory, then I have hope that that actually more realistic theory will still protect the Higgs, because the correlation functions should map onto each other. There's lots of caveats to this statement.
But that's not yes. Like a flimsy hope, because 1 over n is not a small number, right?
So 1 over, yes.
If you're right. At 0 at n infinity, you're pretty far away from 0. At
yes, so we'll zero. Quantify that, and so we'll find that even in the small n limit, you're actually still pretty good. And so in most cases, actually, that doesn't even matter. It works for finite n too. And in some cases, there are some small corrections that you get from not being 1 over n that do give you a quadratic divergence.
Doesn't it mean, maybe that's not true, but doesn't it mean that what's actually doing the constellation is not... You have to identify another mechanism that is doing the constellation, that it's not just, it doesn't go like 1
yeah.
over n.
I think we'll do explicitly, I'll show you the diagrams and see how it works. Uh-huh. And then I think it will hopefully become clear where the 1 over n becomes important. The proof for this thing is just diagrammatically, by the way. Like, I mean, in this particular paper, they just count like the...
I can believe the theorem,
yeah.
But I'm not sure the theorem matters.
Yeah, so the theorem matters to the extent that it provides us the following intuition, right? So we start with an exact symmetry in the mother theory, and we have the intuition that once I orbifold that out, that automatically maps to an accidental symmetry in the daughter. And so accidental symmetry is just, if you just start from scratch, are kind of hard to come by, as I will show. Like how do you start writing down that down? And I'm just trying to argue that a useful way of getting to this kind of theories is to start from something like this, orbifold it, which is extremely trivial, and then you'll end up with something that automatically has the properties that you want.
So is your statement, that sounds a lot more general than this business of quadratic divergence, is your statement
yes.
that using orbifolds is a nice generator for getting accidental symmetries?
That's right. Yes. Mm-hmm. That's my statement, yes.
But I mean, as far as applying this quantitatively, is it that you have a high tolerance to 1 over n corrections because your plot is small?
So the 1 over n corrections, for instance, will only come in if I do a non-abelian orbifold. And even if I do a non-abelian orbifold, the 1 over n corrections will come in with g2 squared. And I will show that they are not there for Yukawas. For the top Yukawa, there is no 1 over n corrections that you... It works for finite and also for the top Yukawa, which is the nice thing. Otherwise, it would not be so useful. Yeah.
What about the abelian case?
In the abelian case, it works for finite n. There is no 1 over n. We'll get to that. I'll show you. Yeah. Yes?
I have this vague memory once upon a time that someone told me that there are no non-planar diagrams at one loop.
Mm-hmm.
Does something like that apply here? That is to say that even at finite n, there aren't any corrections at one loop?
No, there will be corrections at one loop, finite n, in some cases. But I'll show that they're under control. So I don't know what the statement is that you're... Yeah, at least I'm not familiar with it, sorry. Yeah. Yeah, it may mean some special case. Yeah, for a Zn case, for instance, it could be true. Yeah. But okay, let's first finish the twin Higgs story before we get to the sort of more exotic stuff. So I start with a mother theory that looks like this, where I have an SU4 and an SU6. The Q is a bifundamental. I have two copies of the Higgs and two copies of the U. And so now I'm arguing that if I do a Z2 projection here, I project this out with Z2, I automatically get the twin Higgs scenario. So the gauge groups break like SU2 cross SU2. This thing breaks like SU3 cross SU3. There's a couple U1s that for now I'm going to sweep under the rug. We can come back to them later. And there is a Z2. This Z2 global symmetry is just interchanging these two subquivers here. Right. And so you may wonder, why did I start off with two copies of the Higgs over here? And so it ends up happening that if you maybe I should explain this here probably. So the projection that I have in mind is the same as that I had before. So gamma is this 4x4 matrix. And so if I require that the Higgs is invariant under this action, then the only thing that I'm left with is the top component. So I will not have a twin Higgs if you want. But so if I have two of these copies, then I can compensate for that by embedding in a flavor symmetry, as we'll see in a few slides. And so this nicely satisfies all the properties. So there is the three-level symmetry is, of course, preserved because this carries over from the orbifold. And then also the one-loop quadratic action. Clearly, I have the C2 symmetry interchanging these two things. So also the quadratic action organizes itself such that I have the accidental symmetry. And so I can truly protect the Higgs at one loop with this sort of mechanism. And this is the cartoon picture, what this looks like in extra dimensions. So you put in the top sector and the Higgs sector, you put it in the bulk of a 5D theory as well as the gauge sector. And then once you project this out, the zero modes will have the right structure. If you do Z2 orbifold, and the two brains, the standard model brain and the twin brain, will each have an SU3 cross SU2 symmetry. And I can confine all the extra standard model stuff that I'm not interested in. I can confine it on the standard model brain if you want. And then these will give corrections to the potential that are not invariant under the global symmetry. But I don't care because they will count with the Yukawas for these respective generations, which are small. So it's not necessarily a problem for me. But so this is sort of where this morally comes from, and you can also try to deconstruct this thing if you like.
There's an additional SU3 in the box here, right? You have two SU3s for the standard model, because you must have an SU3 in the standard model in the box.
No, the SU3 is only part of the SU6.
That's right, yeah. So this thing.
So there is another SU3. And there's
SU3. That's the twin SU3. So I didn't write that down, but if you want, like this, the twin brain will be invariant under the SU3 and the.
Has two SU3s. One is
that's
the twin
right.
SU3.
And the other one,
is ours.
Yeah.
The other one.
Yeah, but then you have SU3 all in the
yeah, yeah.
So, so there are three SU3s.
No, sorry. That's not what I mean to say. So this is not an extra SU3 over here.
Okay.
I'm just meaning to say that the zero modes over here from this SU6 are SU3 cross SU3. And so the only thing this brain is seeing is these two SU3s, if you want. And so I just wrote down the standard model copy. So I just want to emphasize that this brain does not need to be invariant under the SU6. It's only invariant under the zero mode. This is the usual Dirichlet-Neumann boundary conditions, if you want. Yeah. But yeah, there is only two SU3s, that's right. At least in this case. So this is a general strategy. So we had already two examples, a twin Higgs and folded supersymmetry, where we have some accidental symmetries. And once you understand how to build a model theory of that thing, which has an exact symmetry, then that gives you some indication on what a geometric UV completion may look like. And you may explain why the accidental symmetry showed up in the first place. But an even more interesting direction is to go in the other way around. So now I can try to classify new natural effective theories with accidental symmetries by starting with a model theory which has an exact symmetry, projecting it out in some systematic way, and I can fill in what these dots are, and I can generate a bunch more models which are non-trivial and have the same structure. And then once that is done, then you can again try to guess the UV completion, and this is how the RG flow works. You just decompose this thing in the KK towers, and the zero modes will correspond to this side over here. So that's sort of the moral of the story. So now we'll slightly shift gears, and I will talk about some more group theory technical stuff. And depending on how interested you're in it, we can go faster or slower. But this is just, I need to set some notation. So let's say I orbifold by a discrete group G, which has order gamma. So these are just the elements. And I'm going to be just confining myself to the regular representation in this case, which is just defined by this matrix action over here. So in some sense, it's a little bit analogous. Yes? Yes?
But if you have one loop correction to the gauge couplings, that potential is no longer.
Yes, but that's going to be a two loop effect for the Higgs potential.
For the Higgs itself.
That's right.
Because it's still protected by the Higgs.
That's correct. And so if I would take this thing up all the way to the Planck scale, then of course I'm screwed, right? Because then it doesn't work anymore.
It's living by the extra 16 pi squared.
That's right. It is very, very similar to a little Higgs model, if you want. Like, I'm buying myself a loop factor, and that's all I want at this point. Yeah, I think it's very difficult to make these models healthy all the way up to the Planck scale.
So in these models, so what is the Gabapentin theory?
I have something in mind between 5 and 10 TeV.
So this is, in the orbit folding, this is the size of the extra dimension, or is it the
This is where I start seeing the extra dimension in some sense, and then the size of the extra dimension is just like a little bit above that. So I don't have in my mind yet where that.
The reason I'm asking is because you're blocking the symmetry in one of the brains, you can have higher dimension operators.
Yeah.
And if you're looking at 1% corrections, this can be quite significant.
Yeah, but the 1% corrections are for the top Yukawa, right? And so those will be.
But I think Mina is worried about things like, you know, 4 lepton operators.
Yeah.
That will be seen at left and seen at the dots that bound the.
Yeah. Yeah, so those are in principle things one wants to look at.
They're just putting in my mind. Assume that all those things are fine.
No, yeah. If those, I mean, you can have higher dimension operators that correct the Yukawa the potential to the Higgs because you've broken the symmetry.
No, but those will all be suppressed, power suppressed, right?
They may be power suppressed, but the question is, you want a small cancellation.
Yeah, I think at one loop it should be okay, but maybe we can do the estimate later in more detail. But yeah. I was talking about group theory. So what does this thing look like? So what's nice about the regular representation is that it's fully reducible, and it contains every irreducible representation of the group. And moreover, every irreducible representation, denoted by these little r's over here, shows up exactly the same amount as the dimension of the representation. So if a two-dimensional representation, it will show up twice. Three-dimensional representations shows up 3 times. So that and that. And this is sort of, if you like the MET language a little bit more, you can decompose this thing in a block diagonal form like this. And so, of course, I need to embed that in my mother theory. So I'm going to embed that in SUN gamma, where gamma is the order of the group. And all I did here is I tensored this thing into an n-dimensional unit matrix. So I just got n copies of each of these blocks. That's it. And so now it's an.
In the case of Z2, this would just be 1 and minus 1?
Like it would just be this. For n equal 2. Yeah, that's right. That's correct. Yeah, so that the trivial representation is 1, and then minus 1 is the other EREP. That's correct. And so once I know how this sits inside the SUN, I know how all the fields in my theory will transform under this thing, and I can start asking the question, how are these things invariant, and what are the conditions for these things to be invariant? The easiest one is the adjoint, probably. So for the adjoint to be invariant, I want this thing to map onto itself. So for instance, let me take one of these big blocks over here. So this is one of these blocks. It acts on A, and then it acts on A with its dagger over here. This decomposes into 2 orthogonal vector spaces, one on which the irreducible representation acts, and the other one on which you just have a trivial action. So the one for the trivial action just gives you an N times DL dimensional block, which is not projected out. So this is just an SUN. SUNDL gauge group, if you want. And if the R is supposed to commute with A, then Schur's lemma tells you that this has to be proportional to the unit matrix. So that's what this thing is over here. So in terms of matrices, this sort of looks like this. And the group structure of this thing is that SUN breaks down this product group of other SUNs, where what's very important is that these integers here, these DNs, they are the dimensions of the irreducible representations, which is fixed for a specific group. So if you give me a group, you can go to the MET literature, look up what are the. So that's in some sense what's nice. It's very predictive in the sense that as soon as I decide what the orbifold group is, then this is coming out, and I don't have any choice anymore. Like, I know what the breaking pattern is. And for Z2, this was trivial because there was just 2 irreducible representations, which each have dimension 1, so I just got SUN cross SUN. But so this is more generally valid. And another cute feature, which is very important, is that there is still this sort of funny unit matrix over here. So if I go to the Lagrangian and I take this trace, this is going to produce me a factor of DL over here. So I need to recanonicalize the fields to rescale the gauge couplings in this way in order to have canonical fields in the daughter theory. So that means that if the gauge group in the daughter grows, the gauge coupling decreases with an amount that's proportional. So in other words, for each of these gauge couplings here, for each of these theories here, the Toft coupling is going to be invariant. And that will be the key feature that cancels the quadratic divergence later. So finally, we can do fundamentals. So let's say that Q is some generic field, which is a fundamental under this theory. So I already told you that you're sort of in trouble, at least for the Higgs, and this holds more generally. Formally, you can construct some sort of projection operator, but like it's really easier to see that what this projection operator will do is it'll project Q onto the invariant piece, and it's just going to have like some sort of block diagonal matrix over here. So I'm only going to keep one copy, and I don't have enough fields to make the daughter theory fully twin in some sense. So that's not good. But if I do bifundamentals, so if I only look at bifundamental fields, then I tensor two of these big things into each other, then I'm going to have some sort of Clebsch-Gordan decomposition between the ERAPs from this matrix and the ERAPs from this matrix. And that will give me enough freedom to have exactly one copy of each field in each sector. And so this is what's happened with the twin Higgs. So really what I had here was a flavor symmetry under which the Higgs was an anti-fundamental, and it's a fundamental under this thing, so that makes it a bifundamental. And then that made sure that I got two copies everywhere. So the rule is that every field in the mother theory needs to be a bifundamental of two groups, either a gauge group or a flavor group. And then I will automatically get the right pattern. And so this generalizes beyond Z2. It just is valid for all groups. You still look a little bit puzzled. Is there anything I can... Yeah, it just this sort of special sum rule, this sort of orthogonality relations for irreducible representations, that the regular representation will contain all L's. So for each of these guys, there will be exactly one copy where its inverse will be there, and that produces the one. Everything else is zero. So that's why this works out. The notation is a little bit heinous, but like in the end, like the result is very simple, as we'll see. So now we can start applying this in some examples. So this is the Z gamma case. So instead of a Z2, I can do a Z gamma with arbitrary gamma if you want. But this is still an abelian group. So that means that all the irreducible representations have dimension 1. So they're just phases, right? And so, from the recipe that we said before, you just end up with gamma copies of the standard model. There is a bunch of U1s, which we'll talk about. And there is now S gamma permutation symmetry for all these nodes. So in terms of quivers, what this looks like is this is now my model theory. So I put in this S gamma flavor symmetry so that I have a nice triangle. Everybody is bifundamental. That's very important. And as soon as I write down this, then I'm guaranteed that the daughter theory will look like this. I just got gamma copies of the standard model. All the gauge couplings are equal, and the Yukawas are also equal. Yeah, so the
here your group is enhanced, so the square representations have things that are charged under, for example, S
three. Yeah, so that will be the regular Q quark, right, in the standard model.
No, S three of R sector cross S three of the other sector.
You mean you're worried about something like yes, these things will be automatically projected out. That's right.
So
that's the beauty of this thing.
So they are not even in the theory. So the S two, so the previous thing that you were writing now. They're just not even...
No, they are there.
They are at one where
they are. In the mother theory, these things exist, right?
Yeah, so they are at one
where yes, that's right, yeah. So they're at one over r. That's right. So these are going to correspond to KK states in the higher dimensional...
You just project out zero modes, basically.
Yes, that's right. That's all it is, yeah. So this is I just get to the zero modes of my higher dimensional setup.
Yeah.
And that's this thing. And so I'm guaranteed that the zero modes does not contain any of these linked fields, and just because of the way it's set up. So that's the beauty of this thing in some sense. You don't need to do anything extra for it. As soon as you write down this thing, then the phenomenologically viable structure just rolls out. And then all the link fields are lifted to be KK states. One cute feature already here, you see that the Z2 from the twin Higgs is now generalized to an S gamma. So it's a permutation symmetry. It's a bigger symmetry here. So it's clear that in this case, because of this S gamma, the protection mechanism will still work the same way it did for the twin Higgs. So you may worry that this is maybe okay, this is nice, this is cute, but it's maybe not that interesting. But it gets much more weird if you do a non-abelian group. So now I have the machinery set up, so nothing stops me from doing S3. So S3 is the smallest non-abelian discrete group. It has it's a six-dimensional group, so gamma is 6. And it comes with 2-dimension 1 irreducible representations and 1 2-by-2 matrix, which is a dimension, well, which is a dimension 2 EREP. And so just from the algorithm that we developed, if I start with this pattern of gauge groups, I'll get 2 copies of the standard model, and I get 1 copy, which is an SU6, just from 3 times 2, and from 2 times 2, I get this sort of weird copy of the weak group. But now one may be concerned that the discrete symmetry of this sector is just like interchanging these two. This guy doesn't seem to participate anymore. In terms of quivers, what this looks like is the following. So I start again with my nice triangle. I get a copy of the standard model, twin copy, and then I get the weird friend in the family, which has larger gauge groups. And you may worry, like, okay, you know, is this thing spoiling the protection one way or the other? And I will tell you that it doesn't. But before I do so, I can show you one more even crazier example. So if I do A4, this thing has 1-dimension 3 EREP. So what the quiver looks like is this thing. So I got 3 copies of the standard model, and I got this sort of super exotic node over here, where I have an SU9 color group instead of SU3. Yes?
Maybe you're going to address it in a moment, but the one thing that confused me about having larger orbifolds is that then you have over-protection. In the sense that you're going to have additional quadratic divergences
So that ends up not being the case. So all of these things are going to conspire. This is the thing that I was saying you may worry about. But so all these things are here going to conspire together to all together cancel the quadratic divergence. So that's kind of the nice thing about it. So they're kind of like, they're all working together. So the Higgs now has not a single top partner, but it has like, it has one here, it has one here, and it has a whole bunch here. And they all work together. And the reason why that works is because of the orbifold magic in some sense. And that is my next slide. So let's first do the Yukawas. Let's say that I'm in some arbitrary sector, for instance, one of these exotic nodes. For instance, in the S3 case, then this would be, the L would be 2, right? So there is now, instead of 3 top quarks, the color group was 6. So I have 6 quarks running in here, but the Yukawas got rescaled by the orbifold with a factor square root of 2 in this case, right? Or square root of DL. This holds for any general DL. I've not shown you that.
Let's do the simple abelian orbifolding, right?
So yes. Okay. So then all of these things are 1. Right. So then in the abelian case, I just have an S gamma permutation symmetry.
Right.
And so that acts the same way as in the twin Higgs, in the sense that if I write down the quadratic action.
But just intuitively, I have now 2 extra copies of tops.
That's right.
So maybe I would think I'm overprotecting.
Yes, but so the reason why that doesn't, this is because if you think about it in the nonlinear sigma model, right, where you integrated out the radial mode of the Higgs sector, then this is what you would naively think. But what ends up happening in that basis is that the couplings of these things are going to get rescaled with the right factor so that their sum cancels the Higgs. But it's easier to see in the linear sigma model, where if I sum over all my sectors I, right, then the quadratic action is going to look like this, where in principle you have some coefficient here, y squared, right, and 16 pi squared. Because of the permutation symmetry between all these sectors, this coefficient has to be the same. I can factor out in front. And so that means that this effective action is still invariant under the full SU12 or SUN gamma global symmetry that I started with. So the Higgs is now still a pseudo-Goldstone, but it's a pseudo-Goldstone of a much bigger global symmetry than it originally was. And the nonlinear sigma model, this corresponds to all these things conspiring together. Couplings work out the right way such that they together cancel the quadratic divergence. So in the Z gamma case, you could argue that this is overkill and like why one copy of the standard model is already bad enough. Why do I need gamma of them? But here I would say in the non-abelian case, I would say it's kind of cute because now you get like some very exotic extra hidden sector that also protects the Higgs. And the way that works Because you may worry that this nice behavior over here, because there's no Z-gamma symmetry, you may worry that this is no longer satisfied, that the Higgs potential gets corrected differently in different sectors. Because I have twice as many, for instance, I can have twice as many tops. But then the way the orbifold works out is that the Yukawa is rescaled exactly the right amount, that the analog of the Toft coupling in some sense for the Yukawa is fixed, is constant. So that means that for the Yukawas, the sectors get rescaled the same amount, get corrected the same amount, so the symmetry is not spoiled by the Yukawas. For the gauge field, something analogous happens. So you have more gauge fields now, but also the gauge coupling got rescaled. But so here there is like, here's where the finite n comes in. So here there is, the cancellation is not perfect. And since n is 2 is not that huge, you may worry, okay, you know, this may be somewhat of a problem. But still you're suppressed by G2. And so if you don't push your cutoff beyond 5 or 10 TeV, then this is a very modest fine tuning. If you put your cutoff higher, then of course this thing is going to introduce a large fine tuning. But the nice thing is that for the largest coupling in the theory, which is the Yukawa, it works to all orders in n. So you don't need to worry about it. And this is, I guess, what I just said in words. So the Yukawas fully respect the symmetry because this dependence on which node I am cancels out. And so I organize myself again into an SUN 2N 2 gamma invariant. And the same thing more or less happens for the gauge couplings, except for this piece here, which I wrote down over here. So this is a piece which does depend on which sector I live in. And so this is not SU gamma symmetric. So this thing will be a source for a quadratic divergence to the Higgs mass. But again, it only shows up if I'm doing non-abelian groups. Because in abelian groups, everybody is democratically treated, and it doesn't happen. So this is sort of the large N thing that we talked about before. So this is the recipe. So how do you build a model like this? So all of this was like, there's some formalism to it that I displayed. But like once you have the general results, you can very easily cook a model yourself. So what are the ingredients, right? So an ingredient is a discrete group of your choice. So you pick your favorite discrete group. Maybe you're interested in like some lattice group or like some whatever prejudice you have. And then you write down this model theory with an SU3 gamma times SU2 gamma, where gamma is the order of the group. You tack on a flavor symmetry. And you make sure that everybody is a bifundamental. So you arrange it in the triangle that we had before. At that point, you let it go. It takes care of itself. So you just find the irreducible representations of G. So you look it up in the MET literature. And then you can just write down what the dotted theory will be. So you don't have to do any calculation. You just write it down. It's fully specified by all these integers that are unique to each group. And then this is the stage where you have some more choice of the model builder. Now you're going to decorate it with the other standard model groups and whatnot to make it phonologically viable. But at this stage already, you're guaranteed that the Higgs is protected at one loop. So that part is taken care of. So now, where are the bodies buried? So I told you that there are some extra U1s that, you know, I said like, oh, you know, we don't care about those. And I don't think we necessarily worry about those. So if you like them for as a portal, you can try to keep them lighter. So what we do is we Stackelberg them up, right? Especially in a higher dimensional context, it's not an unreasonable thing to do. You can lift them without introducing extra Higgs fields. So that's not necessarily an issue. Hypercharge, I didn't talk about. So we don't care about hypercharge for the quadratic divergence because it's small enough that for a 5 to 10 TeV cutoff, I'm not worried about it. But I'll show you in a minute that it's somewhat non-trivial to get it to work out such that the hidden sector is not charged under it. And you may worry about anomaly cancellations, and then I can try to be a little more explicit about UV completions. So let's see what hypercharge looks like. So I can easily charge everybody under the same hypercharge because the U1 is an abelian group, so it's going to survive the orbifold no matter what because I act on both sides. But that's kind of bad, right? Because now my twin sector is charged under hypercharge, and so there's all sorts of problems with precision electric measurements, that kind of things. So that we don't like. So we want to have some sort of private hypercharge for a standard model, hypercharge for the hidden sector. And so that means that it needs to come down from breaking some non-abelian group to two copies of a U1 or something along those lines. But so we already used up all our freedom for non-abelian groups in some sense, because we need everybody to be a bifundamental. So if I introduce yet another non-abelian group, I'll get link fields that we don't like, right? So I get like, well, I get link fields connecting the hidden sector with the standard model sector, and then I reintroduce colored partners, which I don't like. So I need to get everything from three groups. And so we know of three scenarios to do that. So you can either promote these, the scenario that I had before to a U3 gamma and a U2 gamma. And these extra U1s, there's some linear combination that you can take that becomes the hypercharge. And there's another linear combination that becomes a twin hypercharge. And then another maybe more familiar story is you can do some upscaled version of unification. So you can do Pati-Salam or tunneling unification. Yes.
So at low energies, they still gauge bosons of the twin sectors.
Yes, so you need to take care of those. Yes, but so
yeah. There's SU3 that's
yes.
unbroken.
But that
you
will
have
confine.
Any photon as well?
You can
it
have.
Depends on what you.
Yeah, you can have. It depends on what you hypercharge. So that depends on your model. You don't need to have it to protect the Higgs. There's no need to have it.
So what do you do about loopholes and things like that?
Oh yeah, so that's an interesting phenomenological story. That's what Matt and Nathaniel's paper, in some sense, addresses, right? So it's like, okay, what are the signatures of these things? So I'll say a few words on that later.
How do you model
the universe? Oh, I mean, you want these things to be unstable. They need to decay to some.
To some.
They can decay back to the standard model, yeah.
I see.
And we think there is ways to get dark matter in this thing, which would be very nice. But so we're still working on that. But I can talk about this.
Yeah.
So the unification story, the way that works is you just start with one of the standard scenarios, but you make it twice as big, or gamma times as big. You orbit fold it out to gamma copies of these things, and then you break it further to get the standard model. So that's sort of the simplest scenario. It's conceptually very simple. I don't think it's phenomenologically the most viable one or the most simple one. I think there's other ways of getting a private hypercharge, which we think we figured out last week, so maybe I can tell you offline if you like. Sorry?
Tell us, can you say something
and you're not finished? Well,
let's let me finish. Yeah, so we can I can tell you. But
what?
We can withhold our curiosity.
Yes. If you, I'm almost done, so if you can hold for five more minutes, we can resolve whatever curiosity is. Yes, so that is one way of doing it. I'm not claiming it's the way to do it, but it's kind of curious that these things sort of point you to low-scale unification, because this means that I'm unifying at 10 TeV, right, whether you like it or not. And it's kind of tantalizing. And you can do crazy things like going beyond the regular representation, but that's sort of a mess. And if there's any anomalies, I can add some anomalons to the twin boundary and then take care of these things too. It's not necessarily a worry. So then finally, what about these UV completions, right? We know how to do a Z2. You just do it in 5D. You take a circle and you sort of fold it on top of itself along this line. And then you have two orbifold fixed points, which are these red dots over here. And so that's the standard scenario there. For Z gamma, you can think of in six dimensions, maybe if the two extra dimensions are a sphere, you have a U1 rotation symmetry on the axis, and you can take a cone in there and then fold it onto itself. So you have like a conical singularity in the two poles, which will be the orbifold fixed points. And then a sort of more exotic scenario, which at the moment I don't know if it's in what way it makes sense, maybe it doesn't make sense for the permutation group, is that if you have like an n-sphere, you can in principle permute all these coordinates. So this has a permutation symmetry, and there's also two fixed points of this action that you can hope to project on. But so this requires a lot more study to see if this thing is actually, it has no sickness in it. So at the moment, I can't claim that it will work, but it will be interesting. Let's see. Yeah, and then the phenomenology that you, depending on where you put all your matter fields, that you can have one Higgs-doubled model or two Higgs-doubled models, and it mostly depends on how you're going to take care of the hypercharge. What's your choice for that thing? And so we're just scratching the surface here. So we just wrote down a couple examples, but we're not, we don't know yet what is the final word on this. So for the Fino, Mina already alluded to it, that now you have these KK modes. So I can produce stuff in the hidden sector, right? And that's a hidden valley, right? So that's a hidden valley. I have a strongly coupled theory there. I'm going to confine. I'm going to maybe form dark baryons, dark glue balls, whatever happens to live there. Yes, sorry? It sort of depends a little bit on your model, but like it's heavier than ours.
Yeah.
Because there's the matter is heavier, so it confines earlier.
Yeah.
But numerically, it depends on the it depends on how many particles you twinify, right? So like
how many
particles you put in the twin sector. We know that we only need to put the top there necessarily, but if I put more stuff, that's going to affect the confinement scale. So I can try to put like maybe the strains in the charm also if I want to and see what happens there. So generically, this thing will form things like baryons,
pions. They say the minimum thing. They say you just put the top. What's
the minimal thing, then it will confine like an order, a factor of a few above QCD, probably.
A factor of a few,
yeah.
So basically, yeah, okay.
Yeah. So I haven't done the calculation recently, but it's not like they're really, really tied together. So you may hope for exotic collider signatures. You produce these things. They sort of do stuff in the hidden sector, and then they decay after a while, and it may decay displaced. And so you see some sort of displaced dynamics. And another obvious thing to look for is that now the Higgs mixes with some dark Higgs. So that messes up the branching ratios of the Higgs. So you want to look for deviations in the Higgs couplings. And so already now that constrains, that somewhat constrains the hidden sector to be like a factor of a few, like a factor of three heavier than ours, or roughly speaking, because these branching ratios scale like v squared over f, where v is r of f and f is the vef in the hidden sector. So the usual case in composite models. Okay, so let me summarize and then we can talk more. So we think that orbifolds explain some of the features that the twin Higgs leaves unexplained, without messing up cosmology at least too much. And so it's an interesting starting point. And moreover, we think it's very easy now, once you understand this orbifold scenario, to generalize this thing to other models. And we just find that the twin Higgs is just the simplest possible example. And there should be a whole host of class of models that goes out there. And so one possible way of classifying is to use the all the groups that you're interested in. Like just every group will give you a specific model. And the models that you get are determined exactly by the choice of group, and you're guaranteed that the couplings will rescale themselves in such a way that the thing protects the Higgs at one loop. And what's also nice in some sense is that this provides you with a naturalness, because of the KK states that you now have, it provides you some sort of naturalness motivation for the hidden valley paradigm. Because before, people complain about hidden valleys in the sense like, well, you don't really need them, you put them in, and like, why? What are they for? And also, what kind of hidden valley should I look for? And so this sort of paradigm sort of answers both of these questions. It tells you, okay, hidden valleys are useful for this, for a hierarchy problem, and specifically you need this kind of hidden valley. So it sort of chops down the model space a little bit. And these are the open questions. So we are by no means sure that we caught all models, because we just did a regular representation, but there's lots of other representations you could look for. So these are other things. You can see, okay, is any model that looks like a twin Higgs and smells like a twin Higgs, is it always an orbifold, or are there exceptions? This is a very interesting one, because there's no reason why I cannot do this for supersymmetry. I did it for global symmetry, but I can take an n equals 2 supersymmetry, I can orbifold it out, and I get something that's not supersymmetric, but still the Higgs will be protected. And folded supersymmetry is the simplest example, the analog of the twin Higgs. But we expect that there is like a whole host of dinosaurs living over there that are waiting to be discovered. And then killed later, yes, as they tend to do with dinosaurs, right? And then this is also something that we're currently, these two things that we're also currently thinking about. So in a sort of more exotic, wacky land, maybe, I don't know yet if it will work, if it makes sense. If you use orientifolds, you have access to symplectic groups and orthogonal groups. So now you can hope that the top partner is maybe not even charged under an SU group, but under an SO group, or maybe even a symplectic group. And so it seems that the orientifold is going to take care of the rescaling of the coupling in such a way that the difference in Casimir is also corrected for. But so this requires maybe... Sorry?
How much would it improve the tuning? Would it improve the tuning at all? But there is this irreducible tuning of V squared, F squared. So
this is like a 30% tuning or so, with the current bound. So eventually, that's you could say that eventually, if you push the Higgs coupling measurements, then this thing will become smaller and smaller and smaller, and at some point you start believing that this thing is a solution. So it is falsifiable for the reason that you're pointing out.
No, no, I'm saying why go to re-antifaults? Why do you want to do re-antifaults?
Oh, I'm just interested in seeing if I can get this.
Okay.
Up. I'm not saying it improves anything.
Okay.
I'm just trying to lay out the land, like what is possible.
Okay.
In some sense, you could argue that it's yeah. Sorry.
If it's not broken, don't fix it. That's what happens.
And then, yeah, you could wonder about dark matter, because now you got these hidden sector interactions, and maybe they do something useful for you. But so also here, we're just getting started, seeing what is the dark matter.
What is the lifetime of if you don't know the algorithm? What is the lifetime of this glue ball?
Of these glue balls, at least in the setup that was considered by Matt and Nathaniel, they decay in the LHC.
Well,
yeah.
They spend
oh, so it's basically.
But they tend towards a little bit of space.
Yeah. But so one thing that's interesting here, for instance, is that you'll have dark baryons, and you could have dark baryons in the extra sector, and they could actually be fairly stable. And so you could try to. They share baryon number with the standard model. And so you could try to play asymmetric dark matter there, because they have a joint baryon number. So they sort of have a, they share the symmetry. So that's
something. Is there a way to make them mix?
Make them
mix. Oh yeah, that's
okay. Well, I'm quite done actually. So
okay.
Yeah, we can discuss more. But the upshot is that okay, there's a long list of things that I would still like to flesh out,
yeah.
And so we're just getting started. I think there's a lot of interesting questions that one can ask, and many of those you have already asked during the talk.
All right. So,
thank you.
And we have dinner with the speaker today.
Well, I'm flying actually. I have to leave. I'm going to be able to come.
She has another
question.
Yeah. Actually, you already have a
question,
but let's
see.
Is there
the day that the bistro could do dinner for us?
I don't know, Chris.
Chris is the person to ask.
Okay, so Chris will take care of it.
I guess what it's
called.
Any other questions for Renaud during the talk?
Yeah.
What happens if in LEC 1-2,
yeah,
they do not find any new scalar bosons on top of that? Don't find any supersymmetric part.
Well, then what I think that will happen, so you mean like physically or sociologically? Sociologically, I think people will start working on this topic maybe. This thing is, you can to some extent constrain the LHC, but to really kill it, you need either a 100 TV machine to look for the KK states, or you need like a lepton collider to really nail down the branching ratios of the Higgs, because the LHC will not really go well enough for the branching ratios of the Higgs to really disfavor this thing substantially. So for the LHC, it's a somewhat depressing.
So you don't need to see any new quantum.
You don't necessarily need to know, but I am actually more hopeful on the dark matter side, especially after my conversation with Gordon. I think maybe there's a way to severely constrain these things with dark matter. So that's the.
There's a tensor, a top mass.
Right.
You can live with the function.
Yeah.
Because if you renormalize,
right,
it's delta m squared h goes away.
Right.
The heavy mass squared times logarithm.
Yes, yeah. So this thing does have logarithmic divergences because the quadratic does not satisfy the accidental symmetry. No, there's nothing about the top, but the top needs it needs a partner, right? So like the top itself does not introduce a quadratic divergence. But the idea is that if you want to have a symmetry, there needs to be some sort of partner. And that partner, like, you'll be sensitive to the mass of that partner. So if that partner is too heavy, then you're sensitive to that mass, right? And so as soon as you assume that there is a symmetry solution to the hierarchy problem, you need a top partner, and then you don't want that top partner to be too heavy. The way I'm solving that is to make it not colored, so I can have it as light as I want, and I can be natural. That's sort of in a nutshell.
Any other questions?
So you learned this at the beginning of the talk, because in the canonical twin Higgs story, there are questions about what you do with the other particles,
neutrinos,
so on. So can you say something about how orbital folding resolves some of the cosmological questions?
Oh, because I don't have these extra particles. That's the thing.
Okay.
The twin neutrinos are not there. I don't need them. So the standard model neutrinos live on the brain, and they don't have friends. And that's OK, because their Yukawas are tiny. So like, I will not, and I'm not introduced to quadratic divergence again.
In other words, it doesn't twinify them.
It don't twinify them, that's
just
right.
Just HQ, right?
Sorry?
It's just the HQ receptor.
Yes, just the top in the Higgs system, yeah, that's what you put in the bulk. You can put more stuff in the bulk, but the more you put in the bulk, like the harder your life becomes for cosmology, perhaps. Yeah. But maybe it's interesting to put all the quarks in the bulk, or so it's all of these things are like, there's also a huge flavor thing that one could explore here, right? Because I'm telling you that I have an extra dimension at 10 TeV, and I'm not telling you where your colors are coming from, right? So, you know, if you don't do something here, you have a giant flavor problem. So you're gonna have to do some model building there, but there's models on the market that may do this. But so it's something, yeah, again, like something that we just need to get started on. There's many open questions that are unaddressed at the moment. Yeah.
So do you know if you have the whole third generation of the bulk?
Yeah.
Is that significantly more constrained than just the top of the bulk?
You mean the whole third generation? Well, you mean you're worried about the tau neutrino, the twin tau neutrino?
So forget the tau and its neutrino.
Color.
That's fine.
Yeah.
Okay.
Color.
Let's just put the bottom of the bulk.
I think that's fine. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't see that's necessarily more constrained. Yeah. I think that's fine. I mean, there's going to be one bottom. Because the Q is in the bulk,
right?
So that bottom
is
there. So it sort of makes sense to put the other bottom there also, so that you know can marry up and form a Dirac spinner. Yeah, but so a priori you may not need it, but you worry what happens if I don't put it. So there is still quite a bit of what's fixed in the Hadron sector are the gauge groups and the fact that there is at least the top, and then otherwise you have quite a lot of freedom to dream up your own favorite twin style thing. Yeah.
Okay. So let's thank you again.